Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everybody, Seth here. If you like watching A Closer Look, we hope you enjoy two of our politics-obsessed staffers, Sal Gentile and Henry Melcher, talk about the latest developments in the upcoming midterm elections. Here are Henry and Sal in a new edition of Midterm Cram.
Hey, I'm Sal.
Hey, I'm Henry.
So I see once again, in the spirit of this podcast, in the tradition that you've established, you have a little fact sheet.
It's not a fact sheet.
It was a fact sheet.
There are zero facts on here. It was just some jotted down ideas.
There's no facts on your fact sheet?
There's no facts on here.
What is it then?
It was just some questions and ideas to talk to Maria Urbina about, who we're going to be talking later in the podcast. She's the National Political Director of Indivisible. Just some ideas.
I fully support that.
This is a really interesting political moment right now, specifically. I feel like we talk about this being an interesting political moment in the large sense of the Trump era, but there have been some really interesting developments on the right and the left in the past few weeks.
Yeah, in the past couple weeks, there have been some momentous things happening, and I think there are things happening on twin tracks that are kind of interesting to think about. So, on the one hand, you have some major rulings by the Supreme Court upholding Trump's travel ban, his Muslim ban.
The ruling on unions.
The gutting public sector unions. Obviously, Anthony Kennedy's retirement. Republicans obliterating every norm in sight to rush to try to get a new Republican appointee on the court in spite of having already stolen a seat from President Obama.
The money right now has it on Brian Kilmeade.
Oh, that's right. Really? He surpassed Jeanine Pirro?
Well, they're kind of neck and neck, and Steve Ducey is kind of the wild card.
Oh, right. I mean, they already are the Supreme Court, essentially. So they already are.
Public opinion.
They are the triumvirate president. As of right now, we don't know how much this is going to change in the next couple weeks or by the time you listen to this podcast. But as of right now, you've got a couple squishy Democrats kind of saying things like, we want to hear from President Trump about who his nominee is going to be. We shouldn't artificially delay consideration of a new justice. You got a couple Democrats who have already met with him to talk about who he should nominate.
These are senators from pretty conservative states that Trump won.
And then on the other side of the ledger, you have New York's 14th congressional district. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez won an upset victory in her primary against New York Congressman Joe Crowley, one of those powerful Democrats in the country, 20-year incumbent, was seen as a likely Speaker of the House candidate after Pelosi.
And he lost by 15 points. It's one of those nights where you're watching election returns, and I was just checking on the New York Times website, and she was up by 15, 16 points. But it's one of those things where you just expect that, oh, that's one district, that's one area. But then you're like, no, it already is one district.
There's a phenomenon of this that we joke about, not in in the context of primaries, but after 2016, we now, Seth Reese, who's another random show, we kind of have this joke going where every time we watch election night returns, and it shows, oh, the Democratic candidate's up by 5. We joke that with 70-something pre-sex reporting. And then you just are waiting for when the anchor, like John King at his wall or something, is like, oh, wait, hold on. We have 1 million votes coming in from this super heavy Republican district. This county that somehow only has 5,000 people in it has just reported 1 million votes for the Republican candidate. So you're always waiting for that
and
to
is
happen.
That funny thing of like, again, this is only 1% of precincts reporting, but a commanding lead for candidate X, and then you wait 10 minutes.
Oh, they're
like,
always bidding
now
it
it's within
the,
2 points. But anyway, no, and sorry, just to get back, she won by 15 points.
And it really was true that it was a
victory.
Huge, it was an astounding victory, and it's a momentous occasion for the Democratic Party. And it's a moment they should take to reflect on how they're dealing with this era right now, specifically the Democratic establishment. So you've got these twin strategies that people are sort of litigating about. What's the right way to approach this moment that's happening right now? It feels like a very anti-democratic moment. You've got a Republican president who lost popular vote by 3 million and a Republican Senate majority, a very slim Senate majority that represents something like 40 million fewer people than the Democrats in the Senate, something like that.
In terms
of
just Democrats representing more populations.
It's definitely the case.
Yeah, California, and it's like, there you go.
Yeah. You could potentially have a Supreme Court justice, fourth Supreme Court justice, appointed by a Republican who lost the popular vote.
Yeah.
So it feels like a very anti-democratic moment.
Under investigation.
And is under criminal investigation right now.
Which is the point Cory Booker was talking about the other day, where he's like, we will not.
I mean, this game gets played all the time. We all know this already intuitively, but we'll just say out loud. Just imagine the world in which Hillary Clinton is president and is under criminal investigation and lost the popular vote.
Right.
Anyway. Right. But so, like Republicans would even sort of countenance, like, considering her Supreme Court justice under those circumstances.
Well,
but,
just think about the obvious is Obama, that we couldn't nominate.
Yeah,
Obama
forget
nominate
being under criminal investigation. Yeah.
And of course, now
nine
this is
away.
Like so boring to even talk.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there is an election coming up, and my God, Mitch McConnell's not a man of his word.
Right, exactly. Oh, God. Shock, horror.
That sent shockwaves through Washington,
yeah, that we finally found out that McConnell's not a man of his word. But that is a lesson that people should learn, and I hope it's finally hit home. It's a lesson some people have been preaching for years, but finally, hopefully, will now hit home, which is that in this new era of politics, there are no arguments or principles being litigated in these debates. It's all raw politics. It's all just seizing power and exercising it. That's what Republicans are ruthlessly interested in doing. They don't care about the made-up rule that they created, you know, saying you can't support a Supreme Court justice 9 months before an election. And so Democrats need to learn that. Your respect for norms is only getting you steamrolled. Mm-hmm. So you have the option, like you have in New York 14, of running an unapologetically leftist campaign that appeals to communities that aren't usually reached out to by the Democratic establishment, which is what Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez did.
Yeah, and it's what Stacey Abrams is doing too in a really interesting way. Stacey Abrams was on our show pretty recently, and Seth asked her a question about her strategy, which is similar to New York 14, where she's not focused on flipping Trump voters. She's not focused on really bringing Republican voters into her coalition. She's focused on registering new voters, getting new voters out, and turning out Democratic voters, and the numbers are supporting that. So there is a strategy that does bear fruit when you kind of run on progressive ideas and running on bringing out your base. With that said, New York 14 is quite different than some more rural conservative states. And that I think is where the idea that Democrats need to run incredibly progressive campaigns gets a little bit trickier. With that said, I think even Bernie Sanders appealed to a lot of voters in conservative states that typically Democrats wouldn't even try to create a message with.
Yeah. I mean, you're seeing that when people go and they go to states. You mentioned Bernie. When he goes to states like West Virginia or Kentucky or wherever to speak, and Bernie's just one example, but you have candidates running congressional races in these places that are talking about things that matter to people's lives, like healthcare, for example.
Yeah.
And those issues are very real to people, whether they live in a deep red state or not.
Right.
And so you're totally right. Things are tricky. They change depending on where they are. But there's just a moment happening right now where Democrats are trying to figure out what they are, what their identity is, and how they're going to respond to the Trump era.
Yeah.
And so I think the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez race offers them a viable path now. Because think about all the things that she ran on: abolishing ICE, a right to housing, Medicare for all, obviously. And again, this is a very different district than a lot of other congressional districts throughout the country. But these are now things that Democrats clearly want.
Medicare for all seems like a centerpiece.
I mean, that's the centerpiece of anyone.
Yeah, but then again, I mean, we've talked about this as well. Like, look at Doug Jones. You look at Connor Lamb in Pennsylvania, Doug Jones in Alabama. They were not running on campaigns as progressive as Ocasio-Cortez, but they also didn't shy away from Democratic platforms. And we certainly saw in Alabama, Doug Jones brought out an incredibly powerful Democratic coalition. So I think what you can draw from all of these Democratic races is run on a Democratic platform. Of course, there'll be variant in what types of issues you run on, but also just register voters and organize and get voters out.
Yeah.
That seems to be the through line here as well. It's just get your voters out.
Get your voters out.
I mean, really, like get your voters there.
Yeah.
Stacey Abrams brought a ton of new people to the polls and has spent a lot of time just registering voters.
Yeah.
And it's also interesting to see how the Democratic Party does not quite know what to do with Ocasio-Cortez.
Yeah.
They're like so excited because it's this new energy. It's an incredible campaign. campaign.
Well, the Democratic establishment.
Yes, that's right. But because, then also, yeah, she brought down a member of the Democratic establishment.
Yeah. An amazing thing has happened, by the way. There's this interesting thing where, because Ocasio-Cortez is a member of the Democratic Socialists of America, mm-hmm, self-described Democratic Socialist, so you kind of see some like concern among some pundits in the sort of like pundit class saying like Democrats shouldn't move too far to the left, like socialism isn't a viable platform. And even some Democratic leaders, I think Nancy Pelosi, yes, said the other day, like socialism is not ascendant in the Democratic, mm-hmm, Party. So there's kind of like this concern about like a person who identifies as a socialist, like being a member of Congress, which she will likely be because, yep, it's a heavily Democratic district. And it's so funny because I think that word has lost a lot of the meaning and power, yes, that people, the scary meaning, I mean, and,
oh,
the power
100%.
That Republicans tried to imbue it, because they used it for years to describe everything.
When you run,
everything bad that happened was socialist. Yeah. And now it's like, it's just completely lost its meaning.
When you run proud on a platform that you believe in and explain it in human terms, you regain all the power of your idea.
Yeah.
So if you're like, I'm a Democratic Socialist, but I don't know. I mean, there are certain, and, yeah, you're wishy-washy, right, about it. When Ocasio-Cortez gets out there and explains her platform, explains her issues, explains why she's a Democratic Socialist, yeah, she has all the power. The same way Bernie would get out there and talk about Medicare for All, this scary fringe, supposedly scary fringe, yeah, issue. He explains the human side of it, and then suddenly it's a mainstream piece of the Democratic platform.
Yeah.
So it's like, run on issues you believe in and you can explain and you're proud of, and you'll see them go from being these very scary things to mainstream way quicker than people expect.
It's also so much easier to run after Republicans have unintentionally defanged this word by using it over and over to describe, yes, things that weren't actually socialist.
Right. The entire Obama presidency was, yeah, supposedly a socialist takeover, the economy was like rebounding, yeah, and growing at kind of at remarkable rates, yeah, during this socialist takeover.
The Dijon on his burger was socialist. The tan suit was socialist.
Right.
Like, that's a socialist suit. Only socialists wear tan suits.
Yeah.
So everything was socialist. And now it doesn't have as much scary meaning to people. And if anything, Bernie sort of pioneered this thing of like, it's very easy now for socialists to say, what is democratic socialism? I don't know. Look at Denmark. Like,
yeah,
that's what it is.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can say to people like, don't you want free healthcare and, you know, ride a bike everywhere? Nice architecture and stuff. Like, you could have that. That's the future.
Right.
The Democratic Socialists want. So, yeah, it lays out a very interesting twin path for Democrats. It'll be interesting to see how they approach this,
yeah,
moment. But now we're going to talk to Maria Urbina about how Indivisible is approaching this moment.
We'll be right back with Maria. Hi, we are back with Maria Urbina, the National Political Director of Indivisible. Maria, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for doing this.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having us.
So Indivisible is this national organization with local chapters around the country. You are helping the anti-Trump resistance. You're cultivating really interesting progressive candidates. But Indivisible started as a Google Doc.
That's right.
Sal and I were just talking about this. Like, we have many ideas in Google Docs, a lot of like half-finished scripts.
It's incredibly
stories.
Yeah, it's so impressive to us that you actually turned a Google Doc into a multi-million-dollar,
yeah,
national organizing campaign.
Google Docs are where things go to die. How,
yeah,
did you?
Yeah.
How did it go from Google Doc to Indivisible?
I really have to give so much kudos, and I have a ton of admiration for Ezra and Leah, who are our co-executive directors,
mm-hmm,
who are really the co-authors with a cohort of volunteers and friends and folks who were in despair after the Trump election, who got together and really demystified what happens in Congress and how to actually have an impact. What I've heard from groups across the country, Indivisible groups that I've met with across the country, what had drawn them to the guide was, one, feeling similarly angry and distressed and not really knowing how to have agency in that moment, and reading something that made them feel impactful and strategic. So that's the one we take in all of the work, is how are we demystifying this? How are we applying pressure where it really counts and where it can really move either the issue or the resistance or the defense on hurting vulnerable people? And so that was really it. I myself am also a former congressional staffer. I spent 7 years in the Senate. So when I first read it, I wasn't part of that original, you know, the original living room crowd, but when I first read it, I also was really impressed with the level of simplicity,
yeah,
and also how just 100% accurate the advice was on, you know, what it's like to be on the Hill, what it's like to get these calls, what it's like to apply pressure, and how members react to it. And it was a Google Doc with good advice, and that's great. But what was most exciting was to see all of these really like organic local living room groups pop up, whether it was a book club or, you know, we used to be something else, but now we're not. Or actually, I don't know anyone and I don't know any other progressives in my community, but now we're kind of getting together. And that exploded, right? All of these folks took this Google Doc and made it something. They made it powerful. They made it real.
We were talking about this before. Any number of difficulties exist in setting up and creating an organic thing like this. It has been an elusive thing before this, especially for Democrats, to have this grassroots organizing energy and just the groundwork to do this. And I'm curious, obviously, some of it is specific to the Trump era and the resistance to Trump specifically. It does seem to me like there is a degree to which, though, there was a grassroots energy that wasn't being captured that is now being captured, both for Democrats, but also even for people who were specifically communities that weren't necessarily reached out to before.
Yeah, I think that's right. We rolled out our electoral strategy in November of 17, like the kind of formal national one. Folks, the groups have been doing work since last summer, though. And our electoral strategy is called Indivisible 435. So 435 congressional districts for the nerds at home. And that was important to us because it really, it was speaking to the point that local groups and these grassroots volunteers were everywhere. And we could not, we had a mandate to put forward some sort of electoral program that supports that energy and activism everywhere, that we weren't going to pick sort of winners and losers in terms of battleground states only. And so that, I think that's one key thing to remember, is that as the party apparatus, as the key players with a lot of money make investments in elections, they make them based on where they think they can win. And that's pretty much how targets are defined. And so for us, it was really important that this entire map, I don't know if you've ever seen any of our Facebook Lives, but we have the map with all of the dots where all the individual groups are. And we needed to have a program that could support all of those dots. And so one of the things that's been critical to the program has been, how do we have a 50-state program? How do we have a 435 program that supports folks with voter contact tools, with strategies and training to do this work? And that has been really important, because otherwise we have folks who are organizing in Georgia and Alabama and in Tennessee who, for some of them, you know, they're the only ones organizing in their small community because the party has been absent there for so long. So I think that's really exciting to be building. You know, what we're all building together right now is meant to be lasting. And when we look back 10 years from now, not only are we going to look back at the investments we made in building a stronger progressive infrastructure everywhere, but we're going to look back at the number of people who have run for office this cycle and life cycle is remarkable. The reason that we're going to look back and be really, really proud of sort of this pipeline building is because so many folks who have run even in those places where the money doesn't exist, where the infrastructure doesn't exist, or in places where they haven't been called on, right? They sort of raised their own hand and said, I'm going to run because this moment is too critical. And so seeing sort of that in places where there's not infrastructure, folks are building it, in places where there is infrastructure and they're leaving people out, they're not waiting to be called on, and they're jumping up and getting involved. And I think that's why it's been tremendous, especially for a lot of women candidates who otherwise would have been told to wait their turn, or that, you know, this race was too hard. You're seeing folks really compete at every level.
Well, perfect example of what you're talking about, specifically women running, women of color, was New York 14 with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. What was Indivisible's relationship to that race? And then my second question is how you think the Democratic Party sees you guys. Because on one end, you're bringing all this new blood to the party. You're organizing, not for the party, but you're organizing progressive candidates. There's a lot of excitement on the left. But also, someone like Ocasio-Cortez brings down a 20-year incumbent. Can you talk about her race specifically, then how maybe the party sees the work you guys are doing?
Sure. So in New York 14, we were really excited to see local groups there engaged. The New York City Indivisible Action Council was part of volunteering for the petition collection of petition signatures. So we're really proud of our model that is locally led, because oftentimes folks who live in these communities are the right ones to be defining what is really resonating in these communities. So we were happy to see that local Indivisible groups were involved. In addition to the New York City Indivisible Action Council helping with the petition signatures, the entire the Indivisible groups there have a coalition called the True Blue New York Grassroots Coalition. It includes groups from Empire State, Brooklyn, Queens, Harlem, Uptown, Westchester, and they all as a grassroots coalition came together and endorsed her early on as well. So we're excited for that. We're excited to see them getting involved in that way and being unafraid to challenge a Democrat who they felt no longer was being responsive or represented the excitement that they had. So they got involved there. We did everything we could to uplift their nomination of Ocasio, and we are really excited to see that, you know, here is a young Latina who has a remarkable story, who has a remarkable vision on the issues, and we publish an endorsement guide, for example, in November that talks a lot about primaries because we know that it's a sensitive issue for a lot of folks.
Yeah.
It's an issue in which we see folks sort of, we've heard our groups be told, don't worry about primaries. We need you to just get involved in the general. And so we wanted to create a political education opportunity, an organizing opportunity to say, this is where you can offer the most influence. This is where candidates have to really demonstrate to these communities, to community leaders, to the grassroots, what they're really about. And this is where you can change people's lives. Because even, you know, in this instance, Ocasio, Ocasio-Cortez was on the record on ICE. Right, she was on the record on healthcare. She was on the record rejecting corporate PAC money. And if we are able to get involved in a primary to move candidates on these issues to be better and to be on the record, that's what we want. And so in this instance, Ocasio-Cortez was already reshaping the narrative. And for her to win on that narrative and have that be a winning strategy is just so exciting.
I have a little bit of a hobby horse that I want to ask you about, which is that, like, there's this weird sort of like jujitsu that happens where, like, cable news pundits will spend the entirety of their time, if you watch cable news, talking about things like the Russia investigation, for example, which is important on its own merits and people care about it. But you get this sense that, like, if you're watching cable news, it's like the only thing that goes on. And then you'll, like, go on Twitter and some of those same cable news people are like, Democrats need to talk more about healthcare. So it's this weird thing that happens because it's a nice palate cleanser to see what Indivisible is working on and what its candidates are running on. Because when you watch a race like New York 14, for example, you see that candidates like Ocasio-Cortez and other candidates that
she campaigned with Robert Mueller, I think you're forgetting.
Yeah, right. Robert Mueller showed up at subway stops. Yeah. It was all Russia all the time. Yeah. She made her whole campaign about Felix Sater. but it's like a nice sort of check-in with reality on the ground to see that it is the case that people are talking about the issues that matter to them in their daily lives and reaching out to communities that those issues impact. And what you often see sort of cable news obsessing about and then getting mad after the fact that Democrats are not talking about is in fact what these races are being run on.
Yeah, that's right. And I would say that even when you take it even another sort of, when you zoom in even more, when you listen to conversations at the door, I'm pretty sure that they are not just talking about whatever the pundits or the national party saying, this is the thing to talk about, right? Mm-hmm. When you listen to folks at the door, one of the things we're starting to see, and I think we're going to learn more about this cycle, is what is a correlation between activism, how it shows up in the news, and how it continues to be part of the airwaves long after people think that, you know, people are talking or thinking about things. That's another element that we don't think a lot about is, you know, when people are demonstrating in the streets, what is sort of the shelf life of those issues in people's local communities and homes? You know, how long are folks talking about family detention once the national pundits or the national news has moved on? So that's one piece that I think is also important around what we're seeing in this moment, what volunteerism and activism is contributing to, and that's not forgetting about people crisis after crisis. And then a second piece is, you know, all of these districts are different. So I think it's really important to not sort of say, here is the silver bullet. We you know, tested it a million times. That's all you can say. Because people don't buy it, right? People want to know who you are, that you're clear about what you're offering, and that you're accessible. And one of the things we look at when we're looking at candidates is, are you only talking about the are you only willing to talk about the economy in a racially agnostic way? That is insufficient for us, right? Are you only willing to talk about these issues in a way that doesn't demonstrate the way the other side is trying to divide us? Because if one of the things we're starting to learn, and Demos has really great research on this, by the way, if you haven't seen it, around a race and class narrative that we have to do a better job at, and it talks, and I bring this up because I think this is one place where you hear a lot of like, oh, don't mention that, you know, don't talk about race, don't talk about our differences. And what some of this research is showing is that we in not talking about it, we're only letting the right define how race shows up and how immigration shows up, right? By not talking about it, we're actively letting them own the entire conversation. And so we want to make sure that candidates are emerging from this cycle, one, being very clear-eyed about what they believe in and what their vision is, but two, that they're not afraid to demonstrate the divisiveness that is coming, that is strategic from the other side and trying to divide communities of color, trying to divide Americans from all walks of life. And so that's one thing for us that we want to continue to uplift. If there is room to talk about class and race in the same sentence, it is absolutely okay to say how some issues affect people differently. And that, in fact, not doing that is worse for us. It's worse for this movement. It's worse for those people who are never actually going to be spoken to or whose issues will never be addressed fully.
Thank you for kind of walking us through the work Indivisible is doing and talking through some of these issues. I think the organizing and messaging is really incredible, and it's refreshing to see people on the left standing proudly on some of these issues. Before we let you run, are there any races that are really interesting to you that have yet to be determined?
Yes. So we are looking ahead at... we have an endorsed candidate in Massachusetts 1 who is also challenging an incumbent Democrat, Representative Neal. Her name is Tahira Amatul Wadud. She is a civil rights attorney, Muslim faith woman. She's been doing interfaith organizing in her community in Western Massachusetts for a long time. And just, again, another woman who you listen to her tell her story, you listen to her talk about the issues. And she is clear, right? You know exactly who she is and what she's trying to do. And I think that's exciting, especially considering the mass delegation is predominantly men, predominantly white men. There's not a single person of color out of the Massachusetts delegation. So Tahira is an exciting race we're following. So yeah, I'll give Tahira my one of the most
that,
exciting races.
Great. That is a great spotlight.
Yeah.
That is a great spotlight.
Thank you so much for your time. We really, really appreciate it.
Sal, it was really great talking with you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Ciao.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus, explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of two young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When two of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but two trials that ended in hung juries and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law and Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.